Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, our neighbor, Chapel Hill neighbor, Willis Richard. Can I call you Bill today? He's the only person in the history of North Carolina to serve in both houses, the legislature, and also to be both on the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of North Carolina. And he's done many other things as well. And in addition to his private practice in law, he's dean of the Campbell University Law School. If I start telling people everything that you've done, we won't get to the topic, Bill Richard.
It's a history of employment instability.
I love that. We came to talk about David Swain, and I persuaded you to do this because I know you're working on a book, a biography of Swain, and we know him, I guess, as we've talked around this morning. People have heard of Swain Hall, but a lot of people haven't heard of David Swain, who, like you, served in different in several important capacities in North Carolina government, mainly as governor of North Carolina and as longtime president of the University of North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, David Swain was a native of Asheville. He was the youngest of seven children. His mother had been married previously, and her first husband was killed fighting the Indians. So when her last child came along by her second marriage to George Swain, she wanted him named for her first husband. One of the interesting things I've learned in doing this is that was fairly common back then. I've said in a draft of the book that George Swain must have been a very secure man to do that, but I've learned since that it was fairly common. In any event, he grew up in Buncombe County. We don't know a whole lot about his childhood. He went to a school called Newton Academy, run by some Presbyterian ministers. The time came when he had to determine his future, and there was a big debate within himself and within his family and the family's friends about whether he should go to college, as they put it in those days, or go directly to the study of law, which was his planned career. He spent a very brief time as a student here at the University of North Carolina, but the decision was made with encouragement, interestingly, from Chief Justice John Lewis Taylor, that he should go on to Raleigh and, in the parlance of that day, read law under Chief Justice Taylor, that a college education was considered dispensable in those days. If you were going into law, you just went ahead and read law. So he spent a year.
Bill Wishard, he's a young person, high school seniors or a little bit older maybe, and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of North Carolina says, come on and read law with me. I can teach you more than they can teach over at the university. Is that so? I mean,
that is essentially correct. It was just a thought that you didn't need all this other general education. If you were going into law, you went and there were no law schools in the modern sense in those days, at least in this part of the country. So you read law under some established member of the profession. And the Chief Justice conducted his own law school in Raleigh. He was a brother-in-law to William Gaston, who was one of the more famous lawyers of that day, served on the state Supreme Court himself during the latter part of his life. And Swain had a lot of interaction during his year studying law under Chief Justice Taylor with the Chief's brother-in-law, William Gaston. They became fast friends, and Gaston was somebody that when he was governor and president of the university, he often called on. He was very much a mentor to Swain. But yes, he read law, was initially licensed in what were then called the county courts, the lower courts, and in a year or two got his superior court license. And
so how old is he now? Is he
he's in his early 20s. He gets back to Asheville. He was born in 1801. He gets back to Asheville, I believe, in 1822 or 3. And interestingly, he plunges right into politics. He's a practicing lawyer a very short period of time. There was actually a landholding requirement for members of the legislature at that time. So he bought, I put that in quotes, a piece of land from his father so he would be eligible to run. And at the ripe old age of 23, he's a member of the North Carolina House of Commons. He does that for 5 terms. They were 1-year terms in those days. Those terms were interrupted by a year as the solicitor, which the prosecuting attorney was called in those days, in the northeastern North Carolina district, often known as the Edenton District. The reason for that is simply that the solicitor in that district, who was also a member of the House of Commons, in those days there was not a dual office holding provision in the Constitution or the statutes that would prohibit that. So the solicitor dies while he's in Raleigh serving in the House. The lawyers and judges in that area can't get together on the person they would like to have replace him. They all like Swain. He's a young—
How would they even know Swain?
Well, Swain's in the House of Commons.
But, I mean, he's in Raleigh, and they're in Edenton or thereabouts. And if he's going— if he goes home, he goes to the mountains, doesn't he? Doesn't go to the beach.
No, he does go to the mountains. But among the people he knows is James Iredell the Younger, who was governor 1827 to 28, and Iredell is clearly influential in this. The legislature in those days elected all the officers. You didn't have local.
So today we will elect our district attorney or our prosecutor or solicitor. In those days, everything was managed. That type of thing was managed in Raleigh.
The legislature was pretty all.
So if Swain wanted the job and he's friends with the legislature, his friendship in eastern North Carolina would be secondary.
The lawyers and judges from that area, and particularly, I think, I can't prove this, but James Iredell asked for Swain and they get him. And he goes down there and spends a year doing this.
Just forgive me for interrupting you all the time, but you wrote a book about a James Iredell.
That was the father of Governor Iredell. He was on the U.S. Supreme Court.
But is there any connective link between your interest in Swain and your interest in the Iredell family?
Well, not really, but my knowledge of the Iredell family has certainly been helpful in doing this because there is interaction between Swain and James Iredell the Younger throughout from the time Swain is a very young man until Governor Iredell dies in 1853. But anyway, he goes down there and does this for a year, and it actually is very helpful to him in his later career. He becomes well-known and well-liked in the eastern part of the state, despite being from Asheville. And remember that in those days, they were a long ways apart. So it actually helps him later on as he becomes governor, leads the university. But he only does this for a year. He's ready to get back to living in the West and serving in the legislature. He does 2 more terms in the House of Commons. The one thing that ought to be said about his legislative career is he was a bright young progressive. Essentially, he bought into the Archibald Murphy vision for the state. Murphy was a state senator from Orange County. He served from 1816 to 1818. And Murphy had the notion, somewhat quaint at that time. Remember, North Carolina was known as the Rip Van Winkle State during this time. But Murphy said what the state needed to do was develop what were then called internal improvements. Today we would call it infrastructure. But it needed to build roads, bridges, canals, ports, railroads. And when you had this sort of economic infrastructure, you could grow the economy of the state. And the long-term goal of that was to educate everybody. You could then afford universal public education, common schools, they were called in those days. We call them public schools. So, Swain.
Bill Witcher, let me interrupt you again because this introduces the notion of Swain have a partisan position? Or was this just a...
In his legislative days, somewhat surprisingly, the answer is no. The state had not developed into a strong party structure at that time. As he gets into the governor's office in the 1830s, the party lines begin to harden. And he is a Whig. And the Whigs were the ones who, in the 19th century in this state, bought into the Murphy vision. They were promoters of internal improvements and ultimately growing out of that.
What was the other side to that, to the Murphy Whig idea?
Well, there was what would seem to us the quaint notion that government simply shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. This was a Tea Party movement?
This is the 1820s. Well, it was not a Tea Party movement as such. It was just a very narrow, constricted view of what government ought to do. And there certainly were people in those days who thought, no, the government should not be building roads and other internal improvements. But that became the platform of the North Carolina.
Well, I wish I knew more about this so I could ask better questions. But in national politics at this time, this was the sort of the Andrew Jackson idea, and Jackson was not a Whig. His people were not in favor generally of this Murphy's vision, or did it divide on other political?
His people in this state, by and large, were not. Swain was very anti-Jackson. There's really not much on this, but what little I've been able to find, he was smart, and he basically did not let himself get caught up in national tides. He stuck to local and state issues, did not say much at all about this, but what little is in the historical records indicate he and the people closest to him were not Jackson supporters. Well, they had a different vision. So it's really only when he gets to be governor that the partisan lines are hardening.
Begin to harden. I tell you what, we're visiting with Bill Witcher. We're talking about his interest in governor and later university president David Swain, which we hope will be a book sometime soon, but if you're listening, you're getting a preview, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our friend and neighbor, Bill Witchard. Bill has done so many things, including service on the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court of North Carolina, the House of Representatives, and the State Senate. Dean of the Campbell Law School, and on and on and on. And now he's writing what I think of as your second book about an important North Carolinian, David Swain, governor of North Carolina, president of the University of North Carolina, the guy who gave Swain Hall its name. But there's a lot to him. And when we took a break, we were talking about his political viewpoint, which was complicated for us in the sense that he, as you say, he was smart enough to stay away a little bit from national politics and concentrate on the things that North Carolina needed. How did his legislative service lead to his becoming governor?
Well, he actually had one thing in between that we ought to briefly mention. he had decided the time had come for him to get out of the legislature. Having done that for 10 years myself, I understand how people come to that time. But shortly after he ended his legislative service, the legislature made him a Superior Court judge. So he was only back in the practice of law on a full-time basis, a very brief time. He became a Superior Court judge and did that for 2 to 3 years, as I recall, something like that. And again, he was traveling the state in doing this and was building relationships, particularly with members of the bar. And members of the bar, as we know, even more then perhaps than now, but still true, tended to be the political leaders. So he does this for a while. We come to 1832, and the legislature, just as happened when he got to be the solicitor in the Edenton district, the legislature gets hung up on who the next governor is going to be.
Well, what does the legislature have to do with selecting the governor?
The legislature in those days elected the governor, so would be a very attractive situation for people running for governor today. You only had to get a majority of the members of the legislature to vote for you. But they hung up. I'm not actually remembering who the other candidates were. Richard Dobbs Spate, the younger, was one of them. But they were hung up on a governor. And as I recall it, after about a third ballot, Swain's name got put into the mix. And again, I'm not remembering exactly how many ballots it took, but his support built as they went from ballot to ballot until he is eventually elected. D.G., he's 31, about to turn 32 years old at this time. He was, remains, and probably always will be our youngest governor. So the Constitution at that time allows the governor 3 1-year terms. And then they had to take a break. I don't remember how long, and they could do it again for that period of time. But he does 3 1-year terms as governor. And during this time, he is a very activist in our modern terms governor. I mean, particularly in the context of his day. He was very much promoting internal improvements. The state had a board of internal improvements, and he served on it himself. The other thing, looking ahead, that the legislature had established in 1825 was what was called the Literary Fund. The Literary Fund was designed to start saving money to support what were then called common schools. They had the vision of educating everybody, but there was no public school in the state at this time.
So there were no state system at all for public education.
None.
So people in those days, if they wanted even a first grade education, had to find some community or church or private school for their kids.
Yes, there were parents and local areas that had a teacher and was doing some education, but there was no organized state system. But to get back to this, the governor was by law the president of the Literary Fund. So again, he was working both as a member of the Board of Internal Improvements and as the chair or president of the Literary Fund toward building the infrastructure of the state to develop it economically and looking toward a system of common schools. There were none in his time. The legislature finally in 1839, 4 years after he leaves office, passes the Common Schools Act, and the first one opens. Interestingly, we've just celebrated the 175th anniversary of it. It opened in Rockingham County in January of 1840. But Swain remains very much in touch with all this. He leaves the governor's office and comes to the university, but he is being consulted.
Being consulted on education all the way through, generally. Well, a couple of questions jumped up in my mind as you talked about the way things were organized back then. And one of them is that the legislature, rather than the people, elect the governor. and for a shorter term. The governor now has 4 years, but the governor back then had a much shorter term. So is it a one-year term?
It's a one-year term.
So it looks like he would be on a pretty short leash as a representative of the legislature rather than having a independent program that would be in any way at odds with what the majority of the legislature wanted.
Well, he was, and that was all very much by design. And you've got to remember the people in colonial times, the governors were the royal governors. They were the king's representatives, and everything was run from London. And they hated the royal governors. So when independence was declared and the state set up its own constitution, the executive was kept on a very short leash. And the power was in the legislature. He certainly had some persuasive powers, although not to the extent even that governors would today. Today, the governor has the veto power. He did not have that. The governor has a lot of appointive powers. There were not all those positions to which to appoint people then. And everything was really run out of the legislature. But again, he was a creature of the legislature. He had come out of it, been an active participant in it for 5 one-year terms. So by and large, they knew him and respected him, and he knew how to work with them. And he was, again, articulating this vision. I've actually got a chapter in the draft of the book on that part of his life, on the vision and his inaugural addresses in which he talked about this, and his addresses to the General Assembly in which he talked about it.
It seems to me, the way you describe it, that the governor, less of an independent creature as he is today with the authority of being elected by the people, but as an agent of the legislature, he's almost closer to being like a prime minister who's dependent upon support from the legislative body in England. Parliament selects its prime minister on recommendation, I guess, of the crown. But that Swain's activity is dependent on legislative approval, and if he gets out of kilter with the legislature next year, they're not going to elect him for another year.
That's certainly true, that there is some analogy there.
I appreciate that careful dismissal of my—
his power was persuasive. It was not rooted in constitutional or statutory authority. It was the power of his personality, his friendships, and influence.
Well, let me suggest another analogy to help us understand. Maybe more like in typical North Carolina city government governance, the mayor, who often has a lot of persuasive power as the head of government, but not much more than a council person otherwise, sometimes not even having a vote.
Sometimes. Most mayors, I think, do have the vote, but it's one vote. It's no more votes than the other members of the council have. And as his time in the governorship continued, he actually had something of a struggle to get elected to his third term, and it was much closer than the other two elections. And the reason is that you sort of saw a hardening of partisan politics during that time. He had let himself be considered. Remember, the legislature also elected the U.S. senators at that time. And he had allowed himself to be considered for a U.S. Senate vacancy as he was heading toward his last election as governor in 1834. He ended up withdrawing from that. But it was a withdrawal like we often see today, where it became evident that he could not win it. But he would have been the Whig candidate, and it was against Bedford Brown from Caswell County, who was the Democratic candidate, And this sort of resulted in some loss of the rather bipartisan, in modern terms, support he had had previously. I don't remember the exact margin of his last election, but I want to say it was like 9 or 10 votes. So that was going on at that time.
He did get
all the terms.
The maximum was 3 terms
him at that point. Yeah.
Well, we're visiting with Bill Wichard. We're talking about David Swain, who's the subject of an upcoming biography by Mr. Wichard, and he and I will be right back to talk some more about it. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our neighbor, Bill Wichard. Willis Wichard is the only person in the history of North Carolina to serve on the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court and also in both houses of our legislature. But he's writing a book now, trying to write a book about Governor David Swain and President of the University of North Carolina, David Swain. Bill Wichard, interesting politics. I apologize for being so interested in the framework of the politics that I haven't let you tell us enough about David Swain. Let me ask you a question about his personal life. This is a guy who became a legislator at early 20s and governor of North Carolina when he was barely 30. In the meantime, he had served as a prosecutor in one part of North Carolina, a Superior Court judge traveling across the state, but based, I suppose, in the mountains. Did he have time to have any family life? But did he have a family?
Well, when he got to Raleigh, as young men often do, he fell in love with Eleanor White, who was the daughter of North Carolina Secretary of State William White and the granddaughter of Richard Castle, one of the early Revolutionary period governors of the state. And it was a serious thing. He never got over it. He, in fact, proposed to her once and she turned him down, but he persevered. He married her in January 1826. Was married to her for the remainder of his life. Interestingly, the White family lived on the corner of Morgan and Blunt Streets in Raleigh. And during much of his time in Raleigh after he was married to Eleanor, they stayed with her mother. Her father was deceased by this time. But her mother and sisters lived in that house until the 1880s. When the last of them died. And when he was governor, he lived there rather than in the housing the state provided for the governor. They had 3 children who lived to adulthood, a daughter named Anne or Anna, a son named Richard Caswell Swain for his great-grandfather, and a daughter named Ellie, about whom most people, if they know anything about Swain, they know about Ellie and her romance.
I bet a lot of people listening know what you're talking about, and I bet a lot of people don't.
Well, we're jumping way ahead chronologically here, but when the Civil War ended, Swain actually had a very key role in that. He had taught Zeb Vance, who was then the governor. And to back up a little for an interesting little tidbit, Vance's mother had been Swain's high school sweetheart. So the time comes when Vance is ready to go to college. And he writes Governor Swain, then president of the university, and he says, "It's time for me to go to college, but I don't have the money." And Swain writes him and says, "Come on, we'll take care of it." And he takes care of it. Not altogether clear exactly how. I'm aware of one note from Vance to Swain, and I'm thinking the amount was $111.11, so probably a loan. I have the sense he also gave him some money. And the university in those days let some students come free. The truth is, the university was mainly a place for the sons of the planter, mercantile, and professional classes. But Swain opened it up somewhat to what would be called commoners, the common people. So in any event, he takes Vance under his wing, sees him through an education at the university. So when the end of the war is coming, Swain sees it, that this is about Appomattox time, and Swain sees no need for the bloodshed to continue. He contacts former Governor William A. Graham, who lives in Hillsborough, with a suggestion that they and the other living former governors be appointed by Vance as commissioners to go negotiate with Sherman, who is marching toward Raleigh, to try to save the Capitol and the university, the buildings, the papers, everything about the government and the state university. Graham vetoes that partially. He says, that's too many folks. We shouldn't try to involve that many. But why don't we just make it the two of us? So they suggest this to Vance, and Vance appoints them. And they go down around Smithfield and negotiate with Sherman successfully. Sherman has been the president of a military college in Mississippi. So Swain sort of relates to him as one college president to another. They get along well. And Sherman promises, so long as his troops are not attacked, that he will not destroy the buildings and property of the state and its university. Now, jumping ahead, when Swain gets back to Chapel Hill from this, the federal troops come in. He goes to New Hope Creek to meet them, and they come on in and occupy Chapel Hill. They are under the command of a general named Smith Dykens Atkins from Illinois. And on the first night, I think, in any event, very early in their time there, he pays a courtesy call on the president of the university. Altogether appropriate protocol. And Swain, the truth is, was sort of the leader of the town as well as the university. Well, they develop the fact that they have a common interest in the Revolutionary War period. Swain is the proud owner of one of General Cornwallis's order books, and he sends upstairs to have this brought to show his distinguished guest. It is brought downstairs by Swain's 22-year-old daughter, Eleanor, better known as Ella or Ellie, and the sparks fly instantly. He starts coming back with regularity. He sends the Union Army band over to serenade her at night. And to shorten the story, this is April 1865. In August 1865, they are married. And it is a huge, huge scandal. I've tried to think of a modern analogy that would enable people to understand why this is such a scandal. Suppose one of George W. Bush's twins had married one of the 9/11 terrorist plotters who was not on the plane in December of 2001.
Now, that's a big stretch. Yeah.
2001, but after the attacks that September.
The feelings were that bad.
But the, quote, Yankees were perceived in Southern minds every bit as badly as the terrorists were at that time. They had come in, pillaged everybody's property, raped the women. The image was that these were foreign attackers on our soil. So this was a very unpopular thing and contributed ultimately, along with some other things, to Swain's downfall when the time came and he was removed as president of the university.
Well, this is a story we could talk about for a long time, and we do have to take a break. If you joined us late, Bill Wichard is telling us about David Swain, governor of North Carolina and president of the University of North Carolina during the Civil War. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about David Swain. You know, you've heard of Swain Hall, and maybe if you've been listening, you remember that president of the university, David Swain's daughter, married a Yankee general. And we've got the expert telling us more about David Swain Bill Wichard is writing his biography. And Bill Wichard, thanks for jumping around with us in his life. I'm curious about how this governor of North Carolina, who never went except for a few days maybe to the University of North Carolina, was named to be won the office of president of the University of North Carolina and was president for a pretty long time.
In Swain's last year as governor, January 24th, 1835, Joseph Caldwell died. Caldwell had been president of the university for many years, was really the first person with that title. There were others who were called presiding professors, but Caldwell was actually president twice. He did it for some years, resigned and went back to the faculty, and then two or three years later was called back into it and did it until his death. In those days, the university trustees didn't get in a hurry about this sort of thing. They met in June and in December, and they appointed an acting, a presiding professor, as they were called in those days, at their June meeting, decided not to fill the presidency until their December meeting. As I indicated earlier, Swain had gone through an abortive attempt at a U.S. Senate seat, then filled by the legislature, that had not worked out. So basically, political options were foreclosed to him. This is a man 34 years old, not really wanting to go back to the practice of law with no political option. And it's rather convenient that the university presidency comes open at this time. How much of the election was attributed to his efforts and how much just because other people wanted it is not clear. It is clear he made it known he would be interesting. There's a story which I found no original documentation on, but it's told in several places, that he was in the governor's office one evening and just Judge Nash of the state Supreme Court walked by and Swain called him in and ran the idea by him. And he saw that Nash didn't think too much of it. So he says, you go talk to Judge Cameron. Judge Cameron was a Superior Court judge. He's a great friend of the university. If he thinks well of it, we'll consider it. If not, I'll forget the whole idea. Well, Judge Cameron's immediate response was different from Judge Nash's. He said, well, he's been an excellent manager of men. Surely he would also be a great manager of boys. He's the very man for the job. In any event, the trustees elected him president 5 days before he left the governor's office. He was elected on December 5th, 1835. His successor as governor was sworn in on December 10th, 1835. And he moved to Chapel Hill on December 11th and set about getting familiar with this new position. One of the very interesting letters I found is at East Carolina. It was from William Rodman, who was later a justice of the state Supreme Court. And he wrote his father, when Swain had been there a few months, saying, I see Governor Swain every now and then. He lives here with his wife. And he goes on to say he's totally out of place. He said he wants to be social and everybody else is wanting to study. Now, we can be skeptical about the desire of everybody else to study, but I have no doubt that Swain was being very sociable. But anyway, he comes here and assumes the presidency and, as we've said, is here almost 33 years.
It's not unusual these days for a former or a political leader to move into academia. As you look back at the history of the leadership of the University of North Carolina in its early days, the leadership came almost entirely from faculty members until Swain. And it looks like when you make a change like that, there would always be some kind of reaction and people who thought that was not appropriate.
Well, the reaction was indeed very mixed. There was a professor at the university who was a grandson of William Hooper, one of the North Carolina signers of the Declaration of Independence, who said the people of North Carolina had given David Swain every office in their power to give, and now they had sent him to the university to be educated. He was obviously pretty cynical about the appointment. Some of the newspapers were
also
skeptical about it, but there was also some thought that it was a good choice.
Well, Bill Wichard, we knew that when we began this conversation that we would not be able to complete it, but what you have done has gotten us even more excited about your book, and I guess the folks who've listened to us would urge me to say, go back to work and finish it quickly.
I hope to, although these things don't get done quickly.
Thanks to Bill Wichard for visiting with us about his upcoming biography on Governor and University President David Swain. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.